Good morning again. It's wonderful to be back here with you, even virtually. I have many wonderful memories of my time at Reeb, and one of those is a vague recollection that we once had a handcrafting chalice circle. And I have a sense memory of having knitting needles in my hand sitting in the Reeb lobby long before the reconstruction, and Bevo was trying to teach me how to knit. And I don't think I got very far then, honestly, which was not her fault at all. I seriously began to learn to knit in the spring of 2010 in a class taught by a friend in Chicago. And other than periods of injury, I think I've knitted every day since. And so I think about knitting a lot. And I have a habit of seeing other parts of the world, other parts of our lives in community through the lens of knitting and fabric. Even our Unitarian Universalist congregations. Our principles call us to see that we live our lives knit into the fabric of relationships. In each and every interaction we have, from the time we are conceived until we die, we are knitted into the lives of those around us and the lives of the rest of the planet. In fact, we enter a fabric already created before we came along. And our threads change the fabric others are born into after we have died. We are each and all responsible for the strength and the wholeness of that fabric. So I want to spend a little time with a couple of ways of thinking about our communities through the lens of knitting. Now, will you close your eyes for a moment and take a couple of breaths and just notice what comes to your mind's eye when I say the word knitting or knitter? How many of you imagine someone who identified as female? Now, despite a history which strongly suggests that fabric work, including knitting, was once an activity for men, or at least for men and women both, imagining or seeing a male knitter is still not a regular occurrence for many of us. Every few weeks, there's an article in some paper very breathless about the fact that, oh my gosh, there are men who knit. Very soon after I finished that knitting class, I joined a Friday evening knitting group. And when I arrived in the back of the Barnes & Noble with my knitting bag in hand, I was greeted with a welcome of such vehemence and joy that I was taken aback. A man! Welcome! We're so glad you're here. See? A man! Things settled down quickly after that. Now, knitting groups are some of the most supportive, kind, helpful groups of humans I have encountered anywhere. The sharing of ideas and skills and attention is so broad and universal. If you need help, you get help from the person in the group who can offer it best, often several people. I'm not sure that these past months, now almost a year of sheltering in place at home, would have been so livable without my knitting groups that meet weekly on Zoom. But still, too often, the same welcome greets male knitters. It's unnerving and not the kind of attention male knitters are seeking. We're looking for community, not to be a novelty, not to be the representative of balance or diversity. I was in a yarn shop a while ago, I won't share which one, and I mentioned these experiences to the saleswoman. Without a breath, she launched into a 20-minute sharing of the challenges she'd had as a woman in the Navy. She had a fascinating and honestly a painful story, and she completely ignored my experience. I experienced her story not as one of solidarity, but as one of belittling, of trying to top my story. Now, I am a white, affluent, well-educated, cisgendered man. I can name on one hand the number of times that my experience has been ignored or belittled like this. And I'm talking about knitting, which is important to me and to many, many other people, but is rarely a dangerous or violently contested identity. I certainly haven't faced the resistance like that felt by Mary Walker. I certainly haven't faced the resistance by many people in minority communities breaking into new professions. But in stories told to me by my female friends, my less affluent friends, my friends of color, my trans friends, this happens to them all the time. Their experience is ignored, belittled, or explained away. Sometimes this can be merely irritating, but a pattern of it can be painful and demeaning. And for many of our neighbors without authority or safety in our social systems, it can be dangerous. When a person of color shares with a white friend that she experienced a comment of theirs as painful, and the friend explains to her that she just didn't understand where they were coming from, her experience is negated. When a trans friend shares that their experience of a job interview was painfully transphobic, and another friend begins to immediately share stories of bad job interviews, the first friend's injury and pain are ignored. When a member of Congress shares how she was accosted and mocked by a fellow congressperson, and that person and the press talk about her as being disruptive and aggressive, her experience and that of many other women is dismissed. When a Black person shares their experience of violence and intimidation at the hands of a police officer, and we respond by telling stories of good cops, their fear and anger are discounted as overreaction. We see again and again the stories and voices of our neighbors and kin being silenced. So often, the response of authority, the response of power, is to ask the injured, the quirky, the expressive, the nonconforming to take full responsibility to prevent abuse and violence. If you weren't wearing that dress or those pants or that makeup, you wouldn't have been attacked. If you understood things the way I do, you wouldn't feel that way. If you didn't act like a sissy, you wouldn't get bullied. It's a demeaning and cowardly response. It denies the reality and meaningfulness of a person's experience and their desire and need to fully inhabit their life. It asks that the other person take responsibility for our discomfort. And it refuses to take responsibility for our own actions. It stops our ability to build and live in loving community. Dr. Ibrahim Farajadeh, who passed away in 2016, was a much beloved and revered provost, professor of cultural studies and Islamic studies at Star King School for the Ministry in Berkeley. In 2000, he presented a lecture at General Assembly, which challenged listeners to reimagine religious education as subversive and constructive. In his mind, everything we do is religious education, and our work is to envision a radically loving and radically diverse community and change our hearts and our systems of understanding in order to build it. He said, "None of us is just like everybody else. We don't have to be like everybody else to be guaranteed the right to safe and whole existences. We want to create a world in which everyone is able to discover and define and live who they are becoming, with the option to change several times throughout the course of their lives. Now that's revolutionary. And we are called to recognize that we are inextricably linked to all other life, knit into a vast fabric of existence of which we are a powerful, integral, and holy part. In building the beloved community, in crafting the fabric of our communities, we have work to do in our hearts. People of all kinds come to us looking for community, not to be a novelty, not to be the representative of balance or diversity, but to participate and grow in a community of radical love. Whatever concerns or fears or anxiety or discomfort are in our hearts, as we encounter and build relationship with our neighbors and our kin, is our stuff, ours to examine and question and acknowledge and grapple with. In our work to prepare ourselves to look into the face of the person in front of us and respond with holy curiosity, growing out of respect and openness with love and acceptance as its fruit. Now, the knitters among us will share a sympathetic twinge when I remember that there comes a moment in almost every knitting project, almost every crafting project, where you look down at the work you've done so far on your scarf or your sweater or your blanket. When you look down at this work of love you've spent hours on and notice, sometimes just a stitch or two back, sometimes a row or two, sometimes way back hours and hours ago, you notice you made a mistake. You dropped a stitch, or you knitted when you should have purled, or you did something that left a hole. Now, if you think knitters are quiet, demure people, then you'd be very wrong. The language of sailors has nothing on the expressions of some knitters I've met when the mistake is discovered. Now, the blessing of knitting is that most of the time, a mistake is not forever. If you've done something wrong, there's always tinking. Now, that's an odd word, I know, but if you spell knit backwards, K-N-I-T, becomes T-I-N-K, tink. Tinking is basically the practice of unknitting what you've just knit so that you can get back to where you made the mistake, make it right, and then re-knit what you just undid and continue on your way. This is all well and good. Sorry, my screen just moved away on me. Here we go. This is all well and good if you just recently made the mistake, but imagine you're almost finished the scarf or the sweater and you notice a mistake back near the beginning. Unknitting in those situations can take a long time. It is tempting just to leave it. I was knitting with my mother one day when I noticed a small mistake in the scarf I was knitting. Not back at the beginning, but long enough ago that it would take me more than an hour to tink back, fix the mistake, and re-knit back to where I was now. I said, "No one will notice. I can just leave it." And my mother said to me, "If you leave it there, no one else will see it, but you'll always know it's there." And so, like any sane man in that situation would do, I did what my mother told me to do and began tinking back. When I remember my mother saying to me, "If you leave it there, no one else will see it, but you'll know it's there," I can't help but hear our universalist forebear, Hosea Ballou, talking about living a righteous life and saying, as long as we sin, we will be miserable. As soon as we cease from sin, we begin to experience divine enjoyment. And of course, errors and mistakes and problems can occur in the fabric of relationships and community, just as they can and do in a piece of knitting. Some are small and barely noticeable. Others can be massive and destructive holes and tears. There are those small slips we make, the brief unkindness, the quick misstep, those we can see and go back and correct almost immediately. Think of a conversation you've had recently where you misspoke, or you were a little snippy or inattentive. Think about how simple it was just to say, "I'm sorry, I misspoke," or "Could you repeat that? I was distracted," or "Can we start again? I'm not happy with how I expressed that." Simple to correct, the strength of the fabric renewed by attention and care in the moment. Other mistakes are larger, more painful, more destructive. Sometimes the knitting back is not that simple. It's not so easy to see where things went wrong, but we know there's a mistake there because the fabric has become warped or the garment unusable. Repair is necessary because the garment has been ruined. Think of a time in your life when you've shared in a large mistake, a large wounding. Sometimes we make a choice to say or do something that turns out to be harmful or destructive. Sometimes we've chosen to be harmful or destructive. Sometimes we've turned away from an obvious need. So, how do we fix these mistakes, repair these relationships? Well, just saying you knit back is not enough, I know. Before we can even begin to ponder atoning, repairing, we have to be humble enough to acknowledge that we have the capacity to make mistakes, acknowledge that we have the ability to do harm. We have to acknowledge that we're not always competent, that we are imperfect. And we don't live in a culture that likes people who aren't perfect. We're taught to hide our mistakes or to be so careful to avoid error that we barely step forward into our lives. That's why the reminder of traditions like our Jewish neighbor's honoring of Yom Kippur in the fall is so powerful. Because we do make mistakes, all of us, all the time. It's unavoidable if we're going to live any kind of engaged life. We have to see that we ourselves are capable of harm and that we can be responsible for causing pain in someone else or allowing the failure of important endeavors. And then if the mistake or harm is in the relationship we're part of, then we need to figure out how to apologize, how to make amends, how to do what we can to heal that relationship. Sometimes it's as simple as saying, "I'm sorry, I won't do that again," and sincerely being intentional about not doing it again. Sometimes it requires allowing ourselves to be open to the expression of the pain we've caused. That's when the knitting back gets harder. Sometimes it takes a lifelong commitment to building a different way of being. Our communities don't just make us feel good and safe. They also provide us opportunity to discern and be challenged in our attitudes and actions by those we've chosen to build with. In our religious communities, we have promised each other through our commitment to our Unitarian Universalist principles that we will live together in certain ways, that we will treat each other with kindness, that we will disagree with love, that we will hold each other accountable and support each other in exploration, and that we will open the door and our hearts wide to all of our neighbors and kin. May we commit to doing the work of being aware and of truly listening to and honoring each other's stories and experience. May we build communities that offer the space and trust for all who participate to be their full selves with all of the messiness and messing up included. May we build communities which nurture the humility necessary to say and to hear, "I'm sorry." And may we find ways to re-knit the fabric of wounded relationship into one of wholeness and beauty. Community is that place which we build, and that place to which we come for connection and solace and challenge and hope. It is that place where we craft ourselves anew, not solely in the service of our own health and safety, but in the service of preparing ourselves to heal the world. May it be so.